All right. So, as usual, before I start on a list of things I was going to talk about, let me see, you've just read two chapters and an article draft, and I'd be curious as to what your reaction is to all of them and whether you have any particular questions or comments or things that I got wrong or things I should have said and didn't or whatever. Yes.
I just think it's interesting to think about this and how it relates to the war on drugs that runs a lot of crap, and a lot of people, the main argument or big argument is that a victimless crime will lead to drug possession. And so I just think about that a lot because I think that, and also I think that like drug crime is one of those things where really only a state can claim a right to.
Well, I don't know about that. You could have an individual who just said, you know, I disapprove of drugs and I'll murder anybody who uses them. I bet you could do a, not, you know, a thriller or something of somebody whose, you know, dearest friend dies from a drug overdose and he sets out on a private campaign. But don't know how well it would work, but you might make a good story out of it. Yeah?
I read this really interesting story a while ago on my little news app about a town in southern Florida that was attracting huge numbers of drug dealers. And
in order to
set up the buys, and then sting them, and then just seize everything.
Yes.
And forfeiture. I mean, I think, like, you know, like, I forget the number of detectives, but, like, the section of Bumble for this, like, you know, had, like, $1.2 million in overtime for 2 years, and
yep.
All this really weird stuff. And, like, you know, of course, just, you know, large scale seizures. Although what I don't know is how like they kept attracting drug dealers even after, you know, all of their colleagues got nipped in the same place.
Don't know. But of course you also hear stories of the same sort where it's not enforcing the law, it's just stealing money. That is that you have civil forfeiture, you arrest somebody who's passing through your territory, who's carrying a fair amount of cash, and you say to him, look, you know, you really want to fight it, it's going to be a long case in the court, we'll try to prove that you used this cash to buy drugs, maybe we can, but just let us keep the cash and go home.
According to one of the witnesses, one person in the story, said that cops would, when they were arresting drug dealers, like, just literally, like, take sunglasses and, you know, watches with them and put them on. Now, like, I mean, that's obviously a little shady, but I mean, like, the tone of the article was one of sort of outrage, and I was thinking about, you know, what I know of forfeiture, which is more than most people. I'm like, well, this, like, I mean, except maybe that, you know, I don't see how this is necessarily wrong. I mean,
but it's both forfeiture and entrapment. And the interesting question is how you feel about entrapment, because the argument for what they're doing, assuming you believe the laws ought to be enforced, you say, look, drug dealers will be less willing to sell drugs to real buyers because they're afraid the real buyers might be policemen on a sting. And just if you think about terrorism, my impression is that quite a sizable fraction of the terrorist plots that are detected and prosecuted in the U.S. are plots invented by the law enforcement. And in one way of looking at that is it's a fraud. The law enforcement want us to support them so they make up crimes. But another way of looking at it is what they're doing is making it very dangerous to accept the invitation to blow something up because you don't know if it's coming from a fellow fundamentalist or from the police.
Actually, we just, in class today, I was told a story about a mosque in Orange County, and they kept calling the FBI saying, hey, there's this guy that keeps talking about jihad, and we really think you should investigate him because he seems kind of dangerous. And the FBI basically, it was an FBI agent.
Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't an FBI agent. They were kind of saying, well, that's our guy.
Yeah.
So.
But did they in fact tell the mosque he's our guy?
I bet they didn't.
That's right.
But I think eventually it came out in court or something.
Yeah. And again, you can see that. You can look at that as a clear abuse by the FBI. Or you can look at it as they're making sure that people who wouldn't start something on themselves but might be attracted into a movement are less likely to be attracted in by,
And you mentioned entrapment, but the thing is I learned about entrapment in my Crim Pro class, and it's really hard to like, an offense of entrapment is very, very difficult, because entrapment is not a constitutional doctrine, and, you know, generally, like, you know, courts are willing to say, if you're a criminal, it's pretty hard to entrap you into committing crimes, or at least of the kind that you normally do. I mean, like, if you're like a shoplifter and, you know, inducing to murder someone, that could be entrapment, I suppose.
That is your argument works for the drug dealers, but it doesn't work for the terrorists. Because in his story about the FBI agent in the mosque, presumably the FBI agent isn't trying to find somebody who has already blown up three different things. He's trying to find somebody who feels he'd like to blow things up. And yeah, so it's not, I mean, it applies to some. But anyway, I was really thinking not about legal defenses issue, which all of you would-be lawyers are naturally concerned with, but just about whether, if you're imagining legal systems, whether you approve or disapprove of various features, whether this is a bug or a feature. And that's sort of unclear in this case, I think. But going back to the earlier point about victimless crimes, victimless crimes aren't going to work for a tort system, and they're... Whether they were, if you think about the difference, there's part of, I was just rereading my chapters, and part of the fun of the first one is trying to somehow have a typology of all of the different ways in which we enforce rules, and it's pretty wide range. And if you're thinking about reputation, for example, in at least the simple reputational model is you do something bad, I find out about it, and I then choose not to associate with you, not because I want to punish you for doing things bad, but because doing bad things would make me worse off if I associate with you. And that model is only going to work if the bad thing you're doing is actually bad in a way that hurts me. So that if, from my standpoint, if I find out you've been smoking marijuana, I can't think offhand of any way in which it makes me worse off to associate with people who smoke marijuana, and therefore there will be no such effect. Now, you can imagine if you're behaving in a way which makes you less attractive as a partner for voluntary arrangements, so maybe I don't want to marry you, or don't want my daughter to date you, or don't want to hire you or something, but most of the victimless crimes don't do that either, as far as I can tell. That is, I don't think... It's not clear if it's legal that any of the standard drugs would really make... They might make you a less good wife or husband, I guess, if you divert time and money into that, but I'm not sure if any of the drugs would be very expensive if they're legal. And beyond that, I'm not sure I see a good example for that. Maybe there are some. But on the other hand, suppose you're thinking not of a let me suggest sort of two different models of different things that both look sort of reputational. And one of them is what I've just described, that it's sort of perfectly ordinary rational model of behavior. You do things, people conclude that makes you somebody they don't want to buy from or sell to or whatever. That's a cost to you. Think about the social norm version, though. Let me give you one version of morality and social norms that somebody who I've encountered online proposes and that seems to be sort of intriguing. If we ask, why do we have a set of moral beliefs? Why do we lump together a whole bunch of different behaviors as immoral? And one possible answer is that A, we believe these behaviors correlate with each other, and B, some of them are dangerous to us. So suppose I say that having sex with somebody you aren't married to is a behavior which correlates with robbing people, all right? Which, in the context where you've got social norms against both of them, maybe it does. Maybe both of those are evidence that you ignore social norms or whatever. In that case, it becomes rational for me to be unwilling to associate with somebody who's having an affair, even though I'm not going to be injured by his willingness to have an affair, because I suspect that means he also would be willing to steal from me, and I don't want people to steal from me. So if you think of your norm enforcement in that kind of generalized way, where you've got a whole pool of behaviors, and indulging in any one of them makes us think you're more likely to indulge in the others, and some of them are ones we don't want to associate with, that could conceivably give you a norm-like enforcement for things for victimless crime laws. I suspect probably the sexual ones are probably more plausible than the drug ones historically, in the sense that I could certainly imagine societies where the fact that you were known to sleep around made people think of you as sort of a disreputable character and therefore somebody who they shouldn't associate with. And I don't know if it's true of... That is, I'm not sure if I can think of any of societies where drugs were legal. Because my impression is that with regard to alcohol, which is sort of the really big legal drug, that in most societies, the fact that you were known to sometimes drink to excess didn't really make people think that you were an untrustworthy person, I don't think. And it seems to me sort of as a fairly normal... I mean, Winston Churchill pretty obviously had that reputation, and it doesn't seem to have done him any harm. Yeah.
Well, on prohibition, the whole issue was more that drinking correlated with domestic abuse. That was one of the big things.
Might. You mean in the arguments for prohibition?
Yeah, well, I mean, your classic prohibition was sort of your upper middle class white woman, who took, pity on the poor families, and one of the things that, they always saw was the working class father who, got drunk every night after working and beat his wife.
Yes, well, that would be a reason for the working class woman not to marry a man who was drunk. But I would think that on the whole, the sort of state enforcement makes more sense if you're trying to enforce rules that either hurt nobody or what your claim would be have a very dispersed injury. That is, that's in general, in a sense, a problem for a tort system. Is suppose I'm doing something which really does injury, but it does injury in the form of 2 cents each to a million people. Now, who's going to sue? And that's what class actions try to deal with, but it's not a very good mechanism, I don't think, for dealing with it. So that's sort of one of the arguments that's offered for having criminal law. On the other hand, there's an ostracism kind of approach can work for that, because whatever your mechanism is decides you're doing things which are hurting our community. Standard reputation probably doesn't, because, why do I care if the person I'm dealing with acts that way? So other comments, questions? All right, let me sort of start running through my elaborate typology and see if we have anything interesting to say about it. And I'm going to start with methods of enforcement. And there's I was thinking of them as sort of about three different clusters. And one of the clusters is the one in which the state ultimately enforces. And that includes criminal law, it includes tort law, and it includes privately prosecuted criminal law, the English 18th century system. And in all of those, the ultimate mechanism is the government decides you're guilty of something and does something to you. They make you pay the tort damages, they hang you in the privately prosecuted system, they jail you in our system. So they are all similar in that sense. Then, there is a set which I sort of think is feud broadly defined, and all of them, I think, are privately prosecuted, like our tort system. And they are privately enforced, but not necessarily privately enforced by the victim. That's going to vary. That the extreme case, the sort of the clean case, the one which I like to explain to you because the simplest one is the Roman shawl, and it's privately enforced by me. You wrong me, I'll beat you up. And since I'm just out of jail for attempted murder, you might believe that threat. But then there is the Icelandic one, where it's privately enforced by the victim and his allies. And then there's the Somali version, where it's privately enforced by the victim and his pre-committed allies, where you've got structures. That's looking a little bit more like a state, in a sense, even though it's not really a state, and it's voluntary and fluid, and the membership of that dia-paying group may change over time, but it's still not really quite the same. Then, in any of these systems, you have something we might think of as a social mechanism to judge who is guilty. And that's important because of the point I make in the article you wrote, which is sort of a point that occurred to me at some point, and I think is a neat way of thinking about feud, namely you need some way in which right makes might. And in fact, I was thinking about it as not just feud. That after all, one of the things we want in our criminal legal system is some mechanism such that right makes might, namely some way in which it's easier to convict people who are guilty than people who are innocent. All right? So it's really an issue for all systems, but in particular in the feud system. And then one mechanism is reputation. And that's going to work tolerably well in a small community where everybody knows each other. And yes, indeed, I've seen that car. I heard the conversation where he told you that definitely the car was not rusted out and you didn't have to take up the floor pads to see. And besides, I've known him to behave like that to other people. So, yeah, I'll be glad to help you beat him up if he won't compensate you. That would be one system, which is not going to work very well, I would think, in a really big society, although maybe the web makes it work somewhat easier because you've got better reputational mechanisms than they do. Then you've got a sort of intermediate one, which is what I think of as the ad hoc court. And the Somali is something like that. That is, you've got traditional mechanisms for how we agree on a judge or an arbitrator. Maybe true of the Irish. I'm not sure that I I'm still not sure I understand well enough what was going on, but there's something like that. And then you've got the Icelandic, which is getting even closer to our system, because there's a pre-structured set of courts, rules about what court things go to, but the court has no enforcement power. So it's still a feud system in that the exertion of actual force is all private. So that's one set. So sort of think of the first cluster of mechanisms as mechanisms where the force is provided by the state. Second cluster is mechanisms where the force is provided privately. Third cluster is ones that don't use force at all. All right? And the simplest of those, I think, is the straight reputational enforcement. That's the one where the store keeps its promises to take returns because they don't want the reputation of not doing that, so they have the reputation of wouldn't shop at that store. I've actually recently had an interaction with a seller who was so good about that that I'm wondering whether I should look them up on Amazon and give them a positive review. It's a knife sharpening kit, and it's a very nice knife sharpening kit that I would describe as very overpriced when I bought it, but I figured I would do it. It's, it uses diamond things, and it's set up with... Anyway, I use a kit for sharpening the kitchen knives. It does a really good job. And I have now twice, with a couple of years between them, basically emailed the firm saying, look, it's a nice product, but it's got this problem. And what is their response each time? Yep, has that problem. We fixed it. We're mailing you the replacement parts. I just got them a day or two ago. And from the weight of the box, that replacement parts includes a new set of the most expensive part of the thing, which are the hones, the things with the diamond surfaces on them. And I complained that although it mostly worked, the diamond part tended to just come off from the main part, and I had to re-glue it over and over again. And apparently, yes, they thought that was a problem, so they've got a better way of attaching it. But part of the result is it works much better with the web, because, as I say, what I'm probably going to do at some point is to go up on Amazon, which probably, I don't know if I bought it through Amazon or not, but everything is sold on Amazon, so they're probably on Amazon, or maybe I can do it on Yelp if not, and just say, look, these people are selling a very expensive product, but boy, do they support it. I didn't even ask them to replace the parts. Yeah.
I would say kind of laugh for this, but I love Nordstrom for that reason. You know, really, because it's the same mentality that,
right,
you know, we're going to stand behind this and kind of sure, no matter what. And I think that they were better before the economy collapsed. But it's still pretty darn good compared to most retailers.
Yeah. To take a very different case, there is a video and camera place, San Jose Camera and Video, I think, on Winchester. And part of the reason I trust them is that I have had the experience a couple of years ago going in and saying, look, I've been thinking of buying the following item. You know, which one would you recommend? And after I described my circumstances, they said, you shouldn't buy that. It's a better deal. This was the question of scanning slides into digital form. Mm-hmm. And that you can do a better job by sending the slides in to people who scan them, which got them no money at all, rather than by buying a scanner from us. And the fact that they're willing to give me good advice against their own interest makes me more willing to trust the advice they give. You know, that's right. But in any case, so reputational enforcement of that sort is one very simple example of a way in which rules are effectively enforced that doesn't involve the use of force. A second one is something in which you have something like a court procedure, some sort of explicit mechanism of finding guilt, and then some explicit social sanction. And I'm thinking of the Vlachram, the Romanian gypsies, and the Chris Romani and Marame. So that's a system where, at least nominally and maybe actually, no actual force is used, but they do have an understood procedure for deciding who's guilty, for saying, all right, in this dispute, you should compensate them by so much, and if you don't, you declare you're polluted, it's marame, and the rest of us won't associate with you. So that's a different system. It doesn't involve force, but it's really different from the reputational, because the reason they're not associating is not that they have concluded that this person is not to be trusted. It's that the court verdict said we're not supposed to associate with him, and indeed, you could almost think of it as a magical procedure in that the court verdict made him polluted. I'll come back to that later when we talk about religious supports. You were, yeah.
Yeah, so what if the person just doesn't care if their reputation is bad? What if they can operate successfully while having a bad reputation? I mean, my thought was like a tobacco company. You know, everybody, every day gets sued all the time, and people who sue them win. and, you know, people know they're bad.
What does bad mean? My impression is that most people at this point know that tobacco has negative health effects, and therefore the people who smoke are people who believe that the value to them of the experience of smoking is greater than the cost of those health effects.
Right, and the companies are just, I mean, tobacco companies are just seen, like, in the media and in, like, the public sphere as kind of just sleazy.
I'm not sure what that means. It seems to me that the relevant question, if you said this company's tobacco, aside from the effect that you know you have from tobacco, this company is so careless in their production that they sometimes put poison in their tobacco, that would impose a very serious cost on that company if people believe that. If all they say is, well, you know, your tobacco, like all other tobacco, causes lung cancer, well, yeah.
like Marlboro, for example, is known to put additives in their tobacco that are especially bad, but people still buy Marlboro cigarettes, you know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't know enough because I don't know what additives they put in there especially bad.
I mean, just think like fiberglass, for example. It's one thing that's in certain cigarettes, that's not in others. But fiberglass, so that it makes small incisions inside your mouth and inside all the way down so that you absorb the nicotine, you know. More so.
Interesting. I'd be interested to check the story first to see if it's true, because it sounds though it's getting into my rule of any story that makes a good enough story to survive on its literary merit should be viewed with suspicion. But
okay.
It may be true. I don't know anything about this particular one. It just
seems to me that if, like, you sell an addictive product,
and the people know it's an addictive product,
then it won't matter if you have a bad
sure product. It matters because there are other competitors selling the product. You want the reputation that you get the most pleasure for the least medical consequences. And you will observe that one of the things that's happening at the moment is people offering the same result without most of the medical costs and serious efforts by regulators to stop them from doing it. That's what the e-cigarettes are.
Okay.
Right? The e-cigarette, as I understand it, my understanding is that the major medical problems are not from nicotine. The major medical problem from the fact that you're inhaling smoke, essentially. I think there's some evidence that nicotine may increase heart risks, but I don't think it's a huge effect.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a heart.
So the e-cigarettes give you the nicotine without the burning products, and various people are objecting to them with differing degrees of success. But in any case... But to the extent that many people are choosing to use the e-cigarettes, it seems to me that's an example precisely where once you find out that you can get the benefit without most of the cost, now people start switching to that, I would think. Now, I would have thought that the clearer case is not yours, but the case of the person doing one-time transactions. So that, I mean, there are two cases I discuss in the chapter. One of them is the con man, who you've never heard of before. He's not relying on his reputation. He's relying on being very persuasive. And by being very persuasive, he gets you to trust him and he gets money out of it.
And he doesn't have to worry about his reputation.
Maybe. I was going to take the next case. That one, he may want to do the same thing again to somebody else. But I was thinking that the other case is the end game player. The person who says, yes, I've built up this great reputation and people trust me, but I'm planning to go out of business in another year. You know, I'm getting old, I've got to accumulate enough money to support myself, so I'm going to spend that last year swindling people, turning my reputation into money, in effect. And, you know, that's one of the issues in context where I've thought about that issue, is online. Because if you think about reputational enforcement online, one problem with that is that you can always roll up a new you. That is to say, your identity is defined by things like an email address, maybe a public key if you're using encryption. So you can always get a bad reputation and then create a new person.
Sure.
And, of course, in real space, you can do it, too. You just have to be a corporation rather than a person. People have fingerprints. Corporations don't. So one way in which you could play the endgame game again and again, as it were, is by starting a new firm with the same people. And I, in fact, at one point encountered somebody I was looking for someone to fix my roof. And a fellow came over from one company and, on the whole, we were pretty favorably impressed with his description and stuff. And then I looked him up on the web. And it was reasonably clear, if you spent a little time researching it, that this was the third in a sequence of companies which were mostly the same people and which all of them had developed very bad reputations. and each time they, you know, closed down one and set up another one. So I got somebody else who did do a good job on fixing my roof. But online, there are sort of a couple of different things you can imagine. See, online, you really have two different problems. One of them is you can change identities. And the other is that it may not be easy for me to know how many people are trusting your reputation. Let me go back a step. Suppose I want to solve this problem of I could just burn my identity and start a new one. The way I do it is to bond the identity by making expenditures that will only pay off if I stay in business. So one way of thinking about advertising campaigns is that a company that's planning to sell a junky product for 3 months and then go out of business, it doesn't pay them to spend $50 million advertising it. It doesn't pay them nearly as much as the same advertisement if they're going to be selling a reasonably good product for a long time. The standard sort of story that the economists tell about this is why bank buildings have marble facings. And the idea is that 19th century, some banks were fly-by-night operations. And before you deposit money in the bank, you want to be reasonably sure that the guy's not going to vanish tomorrow. Well, if he spent a lot of money into a building only suited to be a bank, he wouldn't do that if he wasn't going to stay around, so therefore you trust them more. Now, the problem with this in the online context, though, is my bonding is, as it were, my reputation has a certain value. So suppose you know I've spent $100,000 doing something expensive that only pays off if I end in business. What you don't know is how many different people are trusting that $100,000 bond. So suppose I've put up my, in effect, it's not literally a bond, but it's effectively a bond. Suppose there's one way I was thinking you could do it, maybe people do it, is contributions to charity. Suppose you've got some online charity that many people approve of. So I give them $100,000. They testify that I gave them $100,000 and people trust them. And I then can say, look, I wouldn't do this if I wasn't planning to take advantage of my good reputation for some period of time. And now you say, well, that's right. I can afford to lend you $10,000. You'd never burn a $100,000 reputation to steal $10,000. But what I don't know is that you've made that same deal with 20 people. And you would burn a $100,000 reputation to steal $200,000. So that raises some interesting issues sort of for how you would organize reputational enforcement online, which happens. That is to say, if you look at how eBay works, part of eBay's product is mechanisms for reputational enforcement. Yep.
I don't see why that's particular to online businesses. Couldn't a bank theoretically?
You might be able to. It's just that the online business is, as it were, more anonymous. It's hard. If you think of a bank in a given town, very likely the kind of people who are going to put sizable amounts of money in the bank know each other, whereas an online business where it's, you know, anonymous spread across the world. So I agree. None of these are only online, but some of them are more of a problem online. So I thought at one point of whether you could set up a mechanism in which you could somehow publicly guarantee that your transactions were visible, in which you could sort of have a web page such that you tell everybody, only trust my bond if the contract you have with me in some form appears on this web page. Then all of them appear and you can add them up. And I'm not sure if some mechanism along those lines might work, but it's sort of an intriguing thing to think about. I mean, in general, a thing for you people in particular to think about, since you're much younger than I am and are starting your careers, is how various mechanisms that are used in our society or other societies can be applied in the online world that we're moving to, where a whole lot of commerce occurs that way.
So, anyway, sorry. Yep. It just seems to me that there are plenty of firms with terrible reputations who still managed to operate and be extremely successful.
Maybe, but you have to tell, a terrible reputation is a somewhat ambiguous term. I have no objection to doing business with a firm which has the reputation of paying low wages to its employees. It just means I'll get a better deal from them. I have an objection to working for a firm that has that reputation. But, so that it seems to me, putting it differently, it goes back to my earlier point about morality. If your view is people are good or bad, and bad people will be bad in all ways, then you say, well, suppose you also believe that paying low wages is immoral. I don't, but suppose you do. And you then say, well, Walmart pays low wages. Therefore, Walmart is immoral. Therefore, if I try to return something to them, they won't take it. If it generalizes that way, then it would work. But if you say, no, the reason firms are moral or immoral is not some kind of, you know, virtue in their heart, it's how it pays them to behave, and it pays them to pay the lowest wages that they can get decent workers for, because that raises their profit, lets them sell at a low price and get business. They're selling at a low price is great for me, but it doesn't pay them to double-cross their customers because they're a big enough firm so that people will hear about that. And my impression is that the real protests against Walmart aren't coming from either their employees or their customers. They're coming from their competitors. That the real complaint is that Walmart shows up and other firms selling at a higher price go out of business, and they don't like that very much. But there's no reason why that should make me dislike Walmart. And those aren't the people who control Walmart.
So the reputation is really relative to your own interests.
So the incentive is to have a reputation which makes people you want to deal with willing to deal with you, essentially. I think that's a sensible way of thinking about it. And then you have the other case of the sort of generalized morality, which may or may not work, and you would expect maybe not to work as well for firms as it would for individuals, because you think of the individual having a personality. Now, to some extent, a firm has a personality. You would say, you know, maybe a firm which encourages its employees to cheat customers might also be a firm whose employees cheated the firm. Because the cogs in the machine are all human beings, after all. So their personalities might matter. But it's pretty easy, I think, to imagine. I mean, I suspect that there are quite a lot of cases historically of groups where within the group people were very moral and they were very amoral in dealing with outsiders. That I wouldn't be astonished to find out that slave traders paid their debts.
Right.
And, you know, treated their sailors well and so forth. All they did was to mistreat slaves who weren't positioned, and the slaves weren't voluntary participants, so it didn't matter what their reputation with the slaves was. Anyway, yeah.
Can I ask you a question about how the, or get an idea?
Yeah.
I was thinking about something like Amazon, where they sell a lot of different items.
Yes.
From lots of different manufacturers. And certain websites can gain a reputation by attaching their name to it. And so that could be one mechanism. But then the problem with that is that it becomes sort of a showroom. So let's say one website is called, I don't know, Quality Items. So that becomes a name, but then you can go look at their website, and they've done their research, so they only put in good quality products. But then you Google search that product name or Google search it,
yes,
find it at a cheaper price at Amazon.
That's right.
Get it for cheaper, yep. And then so they lose it instead.
Yep. Couple of points related to that. First, interesting contrast between the old and the new technology version is Sears versus Amazon. Because what Sears was doing, I think, was putting their brand name on other people's products. And part of what they were contributing was their reputation. So that you say there are a bunch of different companies that make drill presses. Hard for me to know which ones are good. If I buy one, I'm not going to deal with that company again for another 10 years. So hard for me to find out by experience. But I buy from Sears, you know, once a month, something. And if the drill press is lousy, I won't buy my shirts from Sears. And therefore, Sears has an incentive to figure out what's the best drill press, put their brand name on it. And the same one is being sold outside of Sears. In the Amazon, the interesting difference that occurred between Sears and Amazon is Sears is only selling one drill press. Amazon is selling all drill presses. And the flip side of that is that Amazon is providing reviews and Sears isn't, because the technology makes it practical. So that what Sears was doing, I think, was saying, we will figure out what's a good quality for the price, and we will then just select that thing and sell it with our name. Whereas what Amazon is doing, as far as I can tell, is we're willing to sell practically anything. Because, you know, you go look for stuff, and you get more or less all the brands that are out there, and we aren't guaranteeing the quality, but we're providing this mechanism for reviews by which you can get more information on quality yourself. But now your second point, which is a point that actually shows up in various points in antitrust law, because one argument for retail price maintenance is to prevent the situation where one firm has an expensive showroom and people go to that showroom and then buy from the discount dealer, which means there's no incentive to maintain the showroom. But I think Amazon's system really probably does depend on their having economy of scale advantages such that they aren't getting undersold. That at least my usual experience, now partly I'm an Amazon Prime customer, so I have no shipping cost. And part of my usual experience is that, and Amazon in fact will even point you at the competitors. Alright, the way Amazon is set up, the competitors can take out ads on Amazon too. But my usual experience is that I find something on Amazon and I am unlikely to find it elsewhere for a price which including shipping cost is lower. Not that you never do, but you usually don't. And if the cost to Amazon of what they were doing was such that they had to charge a noticeably higher price, then they would be very vulnerable precisely because the internet makes it so easy to find the other sellers, which you can do all the time.
Well, I'm wondering, yep. So in response to that, I think when they link to the other websites or competitors, they do get like a kickback?
I don't know. They might. They may. Yeah. Although I think they may also just take ads, I'm not sure. Okay. But even if they don't, once you've identified something on Amazon, you've got enough information just so that Google will find you that the other sellers are very good.
But originally I was using Amazon as kind of an example of not being a showroom because they have all the selection.
Yes.
Sometimes, and if you look at something like clothing online, you don't really know what it actually looks like, what it feels like.
Mm.
So, or other things where, you know, I think something like...
Except that the reviews on Amazon, in a sense, are the substitute for that.
Right, but sometimes it's like only one, or sometimes the quality variation is kind of up and down.
But my impression is that usually, my usual experience is that I actually read the reviews. You can get a good deal of information. Because the question isn't just if people like it, but what do they like or dislike? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it turns out that the negative reviews are ones which are objecting to things that don't matter to me. And then I can ignore them, and sometimes it's the other way around. So it does seem to me that in a way, that's sort of the substitute for being able to go into the showroom and feel the cloth. And it's not a perfect substitute, but it's better in some ways and worse in others. But, yeah.
I think Amazon has an advantage too in that, like, I shop there just because it takes, like, one or two clicks of a button.
Yes.
You know, not, and that, sure. I think, cuts out a big...
Depends how expensive what you're shopping for. If you're buying a $9 item, that's surely right.
Mm-hmm.
If you're buying a computer, it's worth spending some more time checking and seeing. And Amazon used to be a good deal for computers before they were finally pressured into collecting sales tax, at which point I think that Apple, if you're a college student or a professor and therefore get their educational discount, I think it's a little cheaper to buy an Apple computer from Apple than to buy an Apple computer from Amazon, although not by much. That Amazon was roughly giving the equivalent of the educational discount. Other comments? All right. Let me see where I was. Right, so I was going to say in the case of the Vacheron case, the equivalent of a court plus ostracism, you then have a problem with that mechanism, and the problem is how do you make the other members of the group actually ostracize the guy? That, after all, if you've been ostracized, you'll probably be willing to work for another employer cheap because you don't have a lot of alternatives. You're an attractive trading partner in a certain sense, so how do we get people to enforce that rule? And I think there is one sort of elegant solution, what I think of as the bootstrap solution, and that is to say that associating with an ostracized person gets you ostracized. And you then have a sort of a self-consistent system where ostracism works because it works, as it were, which is may sound crazy, but of course, driving on the right side of the road only works because it works, that if everybody drove on the left side, we do that instead. So there are systems of that sort. People familiar with the term Nash equilibrium, which I use in the chapter a couple of times, or it comes out of game theory. A guy called Nash, actually, it's named that because Cournot invented it 100 years earlier, but Nash invented a more generalized version and it got named. Have I told you about Stigler's Law? Stigler's Law is that scientific laws are never named after the person who invented them. This is why, for example, the Ricardian theory of rent is called that because Malthus invented it, whereas Marshallian quasi-rents are called that because Ricardo invented them. And I think there are a number of other examples. Now, this raises, of course, the interesting question of who invented Stigler's Law. And Stigler's Law is named after not the economist George Stigler, but his son Steve Stigler, who is a statistician and historian of statistics. And he did at some point tell me who invented Stigler's Law, but I have forgotten. But he thinks he knows. And it's not him. So it conforms. Self-consistent law. Let's see. Other... So that's at least one possible solution. So then another thing, so I've run through two non-force ones, namely straight reputational and ostracism reputational. And then a third one, which is a little bit different, but is similar to this, is via a system of social norms, which I was sort of mentioning before. So you have a society where people somehow have got the idea good people do X, Y, and Z, whatever X, Y, and Z are. And then how do you enforce, and therefore, and part of the rule is you shouldn't associate with people who aren't good people. And then how does that work? And one way it works is, again, bootstrapping, that you have been associating with him, and we know he's a norm violator. I mean, we saw he wasn't in church on Sunday. We don't know what kind of, well, you were in church on Sunday, but, you know, the next day you were talking with him and being friendly with him. We know we can't trust you either. And so that's partly a bootstrap. And the other way it works is what I was discussing before, if all of us believe that norm violations correlate. And that could be an either, it could be moral, but it doesn't have to be. That's part of, one way of putting it is to say, if he isn't a good enough person to realize he ought to be in church on Sunday, he also isn't a good enough person to realize he shouldn't steal from me, and so I better stay away from him. A different way of putting it is to say, being on church and Sunday doesn't really mean you're a good person. It means you're a person who doesn't want to be viewed as a norm violator. It means you're a person who wants to conform for fear of other people thinking, but if you don't want to be viewed as a norm violator, not only will you go to church on Sunday, you also won't steal from me. All right? So you could have, again, a kind of a self-consistent system in which somehow the society has established a set of things, and the reason they correlate is not for the moral reason. That one reason would be for the moral reason, the kind of person who will do this. You know, if you say, well, the reason you did A, B, and C all show you don't care about other people. Well, in that case, doing A signals you might do B and C. But the other case is doing any of A through Z shows that you don't mind people seeing you as a norm violator, seeing you as an outsider. Well, in that case, we can't trust you to follow norms. So that's going to be another slightly different mechanism. And then my final list, item on my list of non-force ways, or maybe in some sense non-force ways of enforcing the law, is religion. And the pure religious case, as it were, is the one where the reason you don't do something is either you think God will strike you with lightning if you do, which is, you could say it's physical enforcement, but it may not really exist, but at least you believe it exists. And the other slightly different one is that you think you ought to do what God wants. And that's, even if God isn't going to punish you, you might say. I mean, you could imagine at least somebody who takes seriously the idea that a deathbed repentance will get you back into heaven. And so you could say, well, there really is no penalty for my sins as long as I'm careful to make sure that I don't die really suddenly with not enough time to repent. But I won't sin anyway because God is good, God tells me what I should do, and I want to conform with that. And I think there's a real element of that in people's behavior. Now, I should say this does get one into an issue that I at least find intriguing, which is the question of what the link is between morality and religion. I had a blog post not too long ago responding to somebody on National Review Online who was claiming essentially that all atheists agreed that without God there was no reason to be moral. It was just a matter of taste, as it were, whether or not you murdered people. And I think he's clearly wrong. But what occurred to me is that I think he's wrong twice over. I think not only do you not need God to believe in right and wrong, believing in God doesn't solve the problem of right and wrong. Because after all, as far as what you mean by a God, you could assume it. You could say what I mean by God is good. But if you don't mean that, suppose you say I believe in a being who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and created the universe. And I say, well, that's very interesting. What reason do you have to think he's good? After all, that being might be the devil. That being might be a moral nihilist. The being might think there is no good or evil. And, you know, I'll tell people about good and evil. It's sort of a good joke on them. He's a moral nihilist with a wicked sense of humor. In order, it seems to me, to go on and say, and this being is good and therefore I should do what he wants, you need some pre-existing basis for a concept of good. You need to say, look, he does X, Y, and Z. Those are good things. He's a good being. I will therefore trust that even when he doesn't seem to be good, probably he is, and I just understand it. So, and of course, once you believe that there's some basis for getting right and wrong without God, then you can do it without God. So, yeah.
What does it kind of remind me of the Christian idea that you can make yourself your own God? So it's kind of like you could have a God that you ascribe to, but he's really just supporting what you already believe about morality. Mm. Just make your own rules. If the effect of that is that you just make yourself your own rules anyway.
No. But anyway, going back to these systems, so one way is literally religions. Another way, coupled with private norms, is you actually believe that it's wrong to violate private norms. So you might be the reason you keep the norms is not because you're afraid other people will know you're a norm violator. It might be even when nobody's watching I keep the norms because I'll know I'm a norm violator. That makes you feel like a bad person. Close to that is sort of general, what you might think of as morality as an incentive, namely the reason you don't do it is you think it's wicked. And that might be religious, but it doesn't have to be religious. I'm distinguishing that from norms, and the social norms are what everybody in your society thinks is wicked, whereas you might have norms quite different from other people and still be controlled by them. Notice that religion also interfaces in a couple of other ways historically with law enforcement. One of them that I've discussed before, especially in the Jewish case, is that it can provide you with a lie detector. Because if we know that you believe in the religion, we then know that you will be reluctant to swear an oath that's not true because you're going to be, either you think it's immoral or you're afraid God will punish you for doing that. And that's not just things like Judaism or Christianity. You can see that in the Cheyenne case, which we haven't really studied, but which I've done in the past, where you swear by the sun and the wind or something that what you're saying is true, and then you get burnt up by the sun if it wasn't true eventually. At least that's the story they tell. I think in Irish law I saw the same thing. There was something I read, I don't think it's in the chapter, where they're talking about the surety of God. I don't know if I mentioned that, but that's, you know, the surety in the Irish law is the person who agrees to make you keep your contract or to pay in the different kind of surety. This was a native, this was the enforcing surety. And there are apparently various contexts in which the contract is structured with God as the surety. And there's a suggestion that there's an earlier version, a pre-Christian version of this, whereas the elements are the surety. And there is some story in the sort of the tradition about somebody who does that and then violates his oath, and then the elements destroy him, basically. So that's a different version. But the general point is that belief in a religion may give other people a way of knowing what's true, which can be very useful. It also may at least be believed to have... To give you a mechanism of deciding cases. If you think about trial by combat or trial by ordeal, these are all methods which in some sense the people participating think about God is going to be the judge, like God judge between us. So do people still read Ivanhoe? It was a very successful medieval novel, early 19th century, Sir Walter Scott. And there's some scene in there where, for reasons I have long forgotten, the villain, who is quite a formidable knight, is fighting a trial by combat with someone else who I think would normally be a formidable knight, but maybe is just recovering from a wound and is obviously going to lose, and he sort of has a heart attack or something, that the villain does at the beginning of the fight. I don't remember what it is, but somehow the good guy wins, virtue is vindicated, despite the fact that you would think not, and at least from their standpoint, that's because God is stepping in and making sure it happens. And I don't know if I've discussed with you Peter Leeson's view of the ordeal system, which was the ordeals are things like, can you pick up a piece of red-hot iron without burning yourself, or plunge your hand into boiling water for a certain length of time and not have blisters appear, and a variety of other ordeals, drop you into water, and if you float, the water has rejected you, and therefore you're guilty. If you sink, we'll pull you out and turn you loose because the water accepted you because you're innocent, things of that sort. And Leeson's theory is it worked. And the reason it worked was the people involved believed in it. Because they believed in it, you only structured your case to end up with your being in an ordeal if you were innocent. This is an exaggeration of the exception, but as a general rule, the defendant has enough control over how the case goes so that he chooses the ordeal if he's innocent. The judges, the priests who are running the ordeals know this, and they therefore usually structure the ordeal to cheat so that people will usually be acquitted. I assume the exceptions are where they're pretty sure the guy is really guilty. And he and Peter actually has evidence, which is sort of what was quite fun of his of the article, that he has two bodies of evidence. I remember one of them was somewhere I think in Central Europe, where there are a whole bunch of ordeals at which an implausible fraction of the people succeed in doing things like picking up red hot iron without being burned. And he also has some details of the procedure which suggests there are ways in which the priest could rig it, like letting the iron cool a bit before you pick it up. But he also has some English cases, and the neat thing here is that if you're dropping people into water, one of the differences between men and women is that women have a layer of subcutaneous fat and men don't, or at least a thicker layer. The result is that women are much more likely to float than men if you just dump them into water, not certain in either case. The result is that a woman is likely to fail that ordeal, and in his sample, all the people who were given the water ordeal were men. The women were all given other ordeals. So I'm not sure he's right. Peter is quite a lot. I think he's fun. He's sort of my standard example for what I refer to as working the extensive margin in economics or in any other theory. That is, the intensive margin is taking some question that lots of smart people have looked at for 100 years and trying to do something new and important about it. And that's really hard to do. The extensive margin is saying, you know, these tools we've been using, they could be used to look at something entirely different. So that ordeals, you're going to be getting a reading from his book on 18th century piracy, and he's just taking economics and economic thinking and trying to understand things that don't seem to fit it. Yeah.
I wonder if, how there's a scale and caliber to do that. I wonder if with, you were Protestant, right?
Yes.
Okay. I wonder if nobody told them that this was going on, so they actually tried it and...
Maybe. I don't know enough about those cases to know what was going on, nor do I know if the defendants had the option of avoiding the ordeals or not. The whole witch trial business, by the way, people mostly don't realize that's not a medieval pattern at all. The witchcraft trials are really starting roughly about the beginning of the 17th century, maybe a little the end of the 16th century. So they're at a point where you've already got a Catholic-Protestant conflict going on in Europe. And I think I've seen at least the claim that if you look at the number of such trials, they tended to be in areas of religious dispute. That the Spanish Inquisition gets an entirely undeserved bad reputation here. That the Spanish Inquisition apparently was strongly against witchcraft trials, and when people were accused of witchcraft, they applied serious standards of proof, and when they occasionally ended up convicting them, they applied relatively light penalties. And the reason was that the Spanish Inquisition had a real problem, namely closet Muslims and Jews, right? They were 1492, a little bit before this, the Muslims and Jews were expelled from Spain. They were a noticeable part of the population. That you don't get expelled if you convert, but of course you may convert or you may pretend to convert. And so the Inquisition was seriously concerned with trying to smoke out the people who weren't really Catholics and were pretending to be, and from their standpoint, witchcraft was just a diversion. Yeah.
Before there was actually the whole witch hunting thing actually got started by a book, Malleus
Maleficarum. I don't know if that starts it. That's the one he will always quote, Malleus Maleficarum.
I mean, witchcraft is sort of a petty crime that usually got fined for,
I don't think a single German book explains why the King of England was trying to prosecute witches. Because James in the 17th century is one of the people who's pushing that idea pretty hard. But that certainly is the one. The Malleus Maleficarum is one that always gets quoted on it. But in any case, I guess the general point is just that religion does provide a set of potential mechanisms. And there's one more one that I didn't mention and should, and I want to go back to the Velocharam for that. And that's that if you believe that being, as it were, officially cursed, if you think about a Marame sentence as sort of an official cursing, has real-world effects. So if you're a conventional Velocharam gypsy, you say, not only does the fact that he's Marame mean that other people will think badly of me if I associate with him, it means that I might get sick if I associate with him, because Marame is contagious. Marame is bad luck. It's pollution. I mean, there's a sense in which the concept of pollution sort of mixes a bunch of related ideas. One of the reasons why people use terms like thermal pollution to mean making rivers warmer than they were before, because calling it thermal pollution avoids the whole question of whether it's good or bad. It means necessarily bad. And similarly, I think pollution in these contexts mixes the idea of something that the divine powers don't like with something that actually has bad effects. Similarly, in the Cheyenne case, where killing another Cheyenne, you now smell of death, and if we don't kick you out of the tribe, the buffalo might not be there next time we show up, because we'll have bad luck because of all being polluted by this smell. So,
you know. Did you explain the Nash equilibrium?
Sure. I should have before I got diverted. Nash equilibrium is a solution to a game in which each player is doing the right thing given what every other player is doing. So you might have, we've got some set of rules determining the outcomes from our interaction, and which might be the rules of physics as well as the rules of law or whatever. And if I say, if everybody else keeps doing what he's doing, and I change what I am doing, will I be better or worse off? If for everybody the answer is I would be worse off, then you're in a Nash equilibrium. So Nash equilibrium is ambiguous in a number of different ways. To begin with, there may be more than one Nash equilibrium to the same game. So the standard example of that is driving on the right versus driving on the left. All right. It's not that driving on the right is better. It's that if everybody else is driving on the right, it's in my interest to drive on the right, and it applies to every other person as well, ditto for driving on the left. There's a somewhat subtler sense of ambiguity in that if I change what I do, that often makes it impossible for everybody else to all do the same things. We're all in some kind of interacting system. So we have to define what they're not reacting means. And the standard example in economics is consider an oligopoly. You have an industry with six firms in it. And what's Nash equilibrium for behavior in that oligopoly? Well, behavior is how much do I sell at what price? If I change how much I sell, the rest of you can't keep selling the same amount at the same price as before, because there's now more of my stuff on the market. So you could either say we define the strategy as a price, and we say if I assume that when I change my price, you all keep your price the same, am I setting the right price for me? Or you could define a strategy as a quantity and say, do we assume that if I change how much I produce, all of you keep producing the same amount? It turns out that you get Nash equilibrium for both of those, and they're quite different. One of them is called a Bertrand equilibrium, and I forget what the other one is called. So that's a real ambiguity in the fact that there's a sense, an arbitrary definition of what it means for other people to keep doing the same thing, given that if you change what you're doing, other people have to respond to it. Yeah?
I guess we want to lose it. Is the Nash equilibrium in that particular scenario collusion? I mean, if there's six...
No. That is to say, collusion would not be the Nash equilibrium, because collusion would allow us to all change what we do together.
So it's independent changes.
The Nash equilibrium is the case where, given what you're doing, what I'm doing is right. But if you imagine collusion, I don't have to allow myself to say, given what you're doing. I'm saying, is what we are doing right? We can all change together. So let me take the simple case. Bertrand equilibrium turns out to be selling at cost. Because what's happening is that Bertrand equilibrium is we assume a strategy is a price. If it costs a dollar to make a widget, and we're all selling a dollar, selling widgets for $2, if I sold widgets for $1.99, I'd get the entire market, be much, much better off. Now, Bertrand equilibrium assumes that when I drop my price for $1.99, you keep yours the same. So then I'll get all the market. So then, that can't be a Nash equilibrium with all of us at $2, because it's true for every single one of us. It would be better off if everybody else stayed the same and we dropped. So the result of the logic is that as long as we're selling above cost, we can't be in a Nash equilibrium if we define a strategy as a price. So suppose we think about that way and we all compete the price down to a dollar, and now we all have dinner together. And we say, you know, this is a lousy deal. What's the point of being an oligopoly? We're just selling at cost. We're just covering our costs. How about we all raise the price to $1.50? Maybe $2. Make it $1.50. All right. That's not a Nash equilibrium, right? Each of us would be better off cutting to $1.49 if the others didn't. But each of us knows that's not going to happen. The others, that we're all watching each other. Maybe we've even figured out some way or other of enforcing our agreement. Maybe we haven't. So that's not a Nash equilibrium at all. That's a cartel, whereas the Nash equilibrium is oligopoly where the firms are competing independently. Anyway, but that's what the idea of Nash equilibrium is. And it's a useful idea, I think, in our context as well, because if you think about things like whether or not everybody obeys norms, or whether or not everybody conforms to the decisions of the Chris Romani, part of what you're asking is that a Nash equilibrium? If the other people are acting that way, does it pay me to act that way? If if it's true for everybody that given what everybody else is doing, this is the right thing to do, you might be able to change it by some way of moving all of us, but you can't change it by individual action. All right. So again, thinking about driving on the, think about Sweden or England where they drive on the wrong side of the road. They drive on the left side of the road. This is almost certainly undesirable in that because most countries drive on the right side of the road. Therefore, American tourists are likely to have accidents when they drive in the, when they're so foolish as to try to drive in the United Kingdom. And therefore, probably cars are a little more expensive because they can only buy cars that are pretty much cars that are designed for to have the steering wheel on the other side. Right? So suppose they want to change. Sweden did it. But the way you have to do it is not by saying, well, right side is clearly better. I'll drive on the right side of the road tomorrow. That does not work out very well. But the way they did it was the Swedish government says, all right, on the following time, on the following day, we are all switching to the right side. We'll have signs. We'll do all sorts of things. All coordinate the shift. All right, that works. Now, of course, that also meant that they were all driving cars that had the steering wheel on from their standpoint now the wrong side. Which would take a decade or so to correct as they replace cars. Yeah.
I never thought of that. So do most car manufacturers make cars?
My guess is that they still do. I don't know, but I have a feeling, though I'm not sure, that India also drives on the other side, and that by now is a significant market, though it didn't used to be. But even just the UK has got to be a big enough market so that you would. Now, of course, there are some models of cars that are only sold in the US or only sold in some other country, but I think that if you're going to sell worldwide, you probably do. Yeah?
Korea drives on the wrong side of the road.
Oh, I didn't know that. All right. That would be another significant market. Yeah.
So people in India probably drive on the wrong side of the road, but not because they need to do a rule.
I see. That's possible. Yeah, sorry. I'm just reminded of some observations in Istanbul a very long time ago when I figured out why it was that the traffic police appeared to have fully automatic submachine guns. Yeah?
I was wondering if you could go back to publicly enforced.
Yes, sure.
And because I was thinking about torture.
Yes.
And certain systems will readily torture. Except there's a difference in status, but like you said that the Imperial Chinese
can torture witnesses, yeah.
Torture slave or something, right?
What? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's got to put an incentive for people to get their facts straight before they present their case.
But it also gives you an incentive to try to stay out of the court system entirely.
Right.
If I report you for a crime, then I might be a witness, and that might be unpleasant, so maybe I should find some other way of doing something. If I dislike what you're doing, maybe I should find a different way, get your grandfather to make you behave instead of trying to get the court to.
So why do they want... So it'll put more emphasis or more of an incentive to enforce norms and customs and kind of...
Outside the courts.
Right. And then also, I'm wondering at the same time, I know for Islamic law, you said that the facts are disputed later, and so at the first level, you can decide on what to do.
Set on the law, what the legal
right. What the law is. So I'm wondering if for those systems, what you do first is you try to see what people ought to be doing in the first place, how they ought to be behaving. And then, if you're still going to subscribe to it, or there's still a fact of dispute, then you go up to that level where witnesses will be tortured.
Now, I'm not sure I understand that. That is I think the general doctrine in China is that you don't expect people to know the law, you expect them to know what good behavior is.
Right.
And that therefore you don't have to know the law.
Right. So that. I guess it's not a law, but I wonder if there's some institutions that facilitate when two people disagree. And this is a right relationship between you two, and this is how you should react.
Might be. That is, the extended family is one thing that's doing that, and a lot of interactions within the family, but I don't know more generally. If we think about the problem, all of these methods have problems. I mean, that's sort of part of the... Excuse me, the right way to play this game is not to say I've picked the right one and now we show it's perfect because it's very unlikely to be true, but you might have opinions that which ones have the worst problems, but they all have problems. And if you start out with criminal, one of the problems is how do you get an incentive to only convict the guilty? where in the criminal mechanism, after all, what's your reward? You're getting a salary for convicting people, and you know, maybe we can make it easier to only convict guilty people. Different problem with the criminal one is we would like you to minimize the costs of doing all of this, but some of the costs aren't borne by the enforcers. So that if you think about the cost imposed on a defendant who turns out to be innocent, that doesn't come out of the police department. I guess some of it comes out of the jail thing because you've got to pay for jailing him. But the big cost of that is that he's in prison for 6 months waiting trial, say. If he doesn't post bond, at least he's got to pay the cost of the bond. But there's also a bunch of indirect costs. If you think about sort of a very simple case, a murder occurs in a restaurant, and the police want to collect the evidence, so they got to shut down the restaurant for 2 days. Well, that could be a sizable cost to the restaurant. You would like a system where they have an incentive to minimize that cost, but it's not clear if they do. Maybe they do because the police, the owner of the restaurant, will bribe them to do their stuff as quickly as possible or something, but that's, I think, what it would take. And similarly, torturing the witness, that's not a cost to the magistrate, who's the one who's arranging for it to be done. And you can even think of cases where they've got perverse incentives. Imagine the case where they disapprove of something that isn't illegal. Well, you could impose quite large costs on somebody without ever convicting them of anything. Or imagine the case, again, where they would like to be bribed not to impose costs. Well, how do you do that? You start imposing costs and people quietly pay you not to, and you'd have to worry about both of those. The first case, the one I was actually thinking about, it's an interesting one because it's one where it's the only one I can think of, actually, where there is a sense in which the imposition of cost is inexcusable, meaning you don't have to do it to do the job, and that's seizing hard disks and computers. That if you imagine that you suspect there may be evidence of a crime on somebody's computer, it is technologically straightforward to seize the computer for an hour, copy its hard drive to something you now have, and then give it back. All right? Or to seize the computer, copy the hard drive to some backup medium, and give that to the owner, who can then rent another computer and reinstall. So a case where you seize the computer and simply hold it looks an awful lot like a case where you're trying to punish somebody for something, whether or not there's anything wrong. And if you read the book The Hacker Crackdown, which is fairly early in computer crime stuff, a lot of that seems to be going on, that the police are, well, in one case it was the Secret Service, and what they were doing was flatly illegal, as was eventually determined by a court, because what they were doing was preventing the publication of a book. If any of you read The Hacker Crackdown, it's a wonderful story. It's quite the guy who wrote it is also a science fiction author. This is a fact book, but it's an entertaining fact book. Steve Jackson Games is an old line producer of originally board games and then later computer games. And Steve Jackson Games was producing a role-playing game about computer hacking. One of their employees was somebody who had a computer bulletin board on which people engaged in dubious activities argued with law enforcement people, basically. It was sort of a communication between these rather different communities. And some law enforcement people follow him, seize his computer, and then follow that to Steve Jackson Games. And what do they find? They find probably wasn't a website then, but some kind of a portal, which is in effect advertising this hacking game coming out, and they conclude that what Steve Jackson is producing is a handbook teaching people how to hack. So they make a surprise raid on Steve Jackson Games and seize all computers and all copies of the manuscript. Now, it turns out that advance seizures of a manuscript republished is against federal law. It's a censorship form. When Steve Jackson's lawyer points us out to them a day or two later, they said, well, we didn't know that. And it takes them like 3 months or 6 months to give the stuff back. Steve Jackson sues and collects from the Secret Service, not as much as he should have, but he collects the damage payment on the grounds they had imposed costs on him. And it seems to me now, in that case, I think it's pretty clear that given their initial mistake, they wanted to prevent publication of the book, which they legally couldn't do, but they could hold the stuff as evidence, or at least they thought they could, for quite a long time, and thus impose serious costs on him. But anyway, so that's, but in general, it's a potential problem. Tort law, the obvious argument for it is the sort of standard argument for private production against government production, but there are also some problems that it faces. One of the criminal law problems, of course, is the risk that the policeman will sell the evidence to the criminal. That is, how do you keep the policeman uncorrupt? That's less of a problem with tort law because the equivalent of the policeman is now the plaintiff, and he doesn't want to lose his suit because he's going to collect damages from it. But tort law has its own problems, one of which is that the damage payment is simultaneously the incentive to sue and the punishment for the person, for the tortfeasor, and there's no particular reason why the optimal levels of both should be the same. This is a problem which Landers and Posner pointed out. If you want to know how to solve that problem, read my article on efficient institutions for the private enforcement of law, which is off of my website, which was a response to their piece, but it's a real problem. Another problem with tort law as it now exists in the U.S. is that the damages are supposed to be enough to make whole, but if you don't always successfully detect and sue and win, then the person who commits the tort has only a 50% chance, say, of paying those damages. So if he is doing damages of $10,000 and saving himself $6,000 by doing it, he'll do it, because it's only a 50% chance of paying those $10,000. So that's another problem with tort. You could solve that problem by introducing a probability multiplier, by saying if on average we only catch and convict a tenth of the people who do this, then when we do, you get 10 times the damages. But that then creates an incentive to forge offenses, that if I can... I run through the example in the chapter, which is in that example is in a context partly where I was thinking about what happened if you convert criminal law into tort law, which is sort of what some of this stuff is coming out of. Further problem is, does the private victim have the incentives to prosecute? And for that, I mentioned the Icelandic solution, which is to make the claim transferable so that if he can't afford to do it, he can give it to somebody else who can, or sell it to someone else who can. What about feud? The basic problems with feud as a system of enforcement, I think, are really two. One of them is you need a commitment mechanism, because it's in my interest before the fact to be somebody who will get revenge if you kill my son or my brother or my friend. But once you've done it, it may not be in my interest to do it anymore, because it's already happened, I can't get him back, and I might get killed in the process of having a feud with you. All right? So you need some mechanism by which I can, in advance, commit myself, so that when the actual event happens, I'll have to carry through on it. And there are various ways of doing that. I discussed in the analogous case in the English non-feud system, but privately prosecuted system, you join an association for the prosecution of felons, or you just internally hardwire vengefulness that, you know, what will I think of myself if I let you kill my brother and didn't do anything about it? Or you socially build in that by saying that I'll lose a whole lot of status if I'm the kind of person who lets you get away with that. I mean, there are a lot of different ways of doing it. That you need some solution to commitment. And the other problem I discussed earlier is you need some mechanism such that right makes might. Since the way I'm getting you to compensate me is by threatening to harm you, we want to make sure that I can't just do that because I want the compensation even though you never wronged me. So you need some mechanism for doing that. Reputational. Discussed a little bit before that it requires repeat transactions. It requires voluntary associations. You don't care about your if you're a mugger, you don't care about your reputation with your victims because they don't have to agree to get mugged. Whereas if you're a seller or an employer, you do care about your reputation. With regard to repeat transactions, as I was mentioning before, one way of thinking of morality is it's a way of batching transactions. So if I say that what's going to make you behave well is you want the reputation of being a good person, and if there are enough different things, all of which we think feed into the reputation of being a good person, then you may be enough of a repeat player so that even on any one of those things you won't be. If I cheat you, if it's a tenant, I'm a bad person. If as a tenant, I wreck the house and never pay the rent, I'm not going to be a tenant again. I'm actually planning to buy a house next year or so. But when I try to buy a house, nobody's going to lend me any money because they observe what kind of a tenant I was. So you can then see a way in which reputation can generalize, maybe, if people have a sort of a consistent enough picture of which forms of behavior correlate with correlate with which. The what else did I want? Now, if I had more time, I'd tell you about economics of vice and virtue, but I won't. But going back to this, to my simplest reputational enforcement one, the great weakness of that system is that when I announce that you've cheated me, you announce you haven't. And the third parties who I want to use to enforce your behavior conclude that they don't know which of us is lying, so they're not going to associate with either of us. At which point, my complaining has hurt me as well as hurting you, and because I know that, I don't complain. People see the logic of that. So what that tells us is that that form of reputational incentive is very sensitive to the cost to interested third parties of finding out who's in the right. All right? That if it's easy for the interested third parties to find out, then they say, aha, refuse to associate with her because she cheated, perfectly happy to associate with him, he was the victim. If they can't easily find out, I never report because... And I've argued that one of the incentives of things like one of the functions of something like arbitration, even where an arbitrator has no way of enforcing his verdict, it's a way of lowering informational costs to third parties because they can know who won the arbitration. We're running out of time, so there's more stuff we could talk about, as you can see. This is a fairly wide area, and I'm sort of sketching things associated. Quite a lot more I could talk about, actually. We'll do more on my outline, but I won't. Maybe next time.